Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Back Half podcast, the New Statesman's Culture podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
God knows what it will be like by the time you consume this podcast, but as we speak, we're huddled down in the podcast room, blazing open fire. We've set fire to all the books that our subscriptions manager was about to send out to new subscribers to just create some warmth in this room as the snow comes piling down onto the streets around St. Paul's. And to warm ourselves through the next half an hour or so, Kate, what are we going to talk about?
We're going to be talking about a fantastic new exhibition at the Tate called All Too Human, featuring the work of Bacon and Freud and many others. We're also going to be talking about Sade, who of course is a band as well as a woman.
Amazing.
Two in one.
Woman and band.
And we're going to have the umpteenth in our non-anniversary season.
Excellent.
So, Tom, in the last few days you've been, I was going to say rediscovering, but in fact discovering for the first time the music of the great Sade. So what has led you back to Sade?
This is a bit like that Alan Partridge scene. In 1991, I did not listen to Sade. In 1992, I did not listen to Sade. Basically, for the first 36 odd years of my life, I've had no interest in Sade. Last weekend, I've suddenly become obsessed with Sade.
Where were you and what were you doing?
I was just pootering around in the house and someone on Six Music played The Sweetest Taboo, which is on one of her first two albums from the mid-80s. I didn't even know she had made so many records before this kind of... The many inhabitants of Sade. So my parents had a copy of Love Deluxe, which is the 1992 album with a very sort of striking graphic cover of a kind of naked or semi-naked, well, you can only sort of see her outline really, but it's a very kind of striking physical form of Sade on the front. I don't know if that's her best-selling record, but certainly that was the one that felt kind of culturally kind of preeminent at the time. And I put it in the same camp as Stars by Simply Red, which came out, I think, the previous year. Just very smooth, very like radio friendly, very dinner party friendly background music. And as such, just sort of completely passed me by. I didn't even summon up the energy to sort of dislike it. It just sort of didn't exist for me. And then my ears pricked up when I heard this earlier track at the weekend. And I've been going back and listening to her stuff, and it's completely amazing. And I don't know how I've been missing out on it for so long. The peg for all of this, the reason why this Six Music DJ dug up this track, was that she's about to release their first new music. Although actually it confuses matters, because I think possibly this new music might be her solo. but first new music in 8 years, on the soundtrack to a new film, A Wrinkle in Time, which is a big Disney movie, which is coming out very shortly, an adaptation of an American children's book, a great American children's book, actually, which isn't that well known over here. So they are not very prolific from, I think, there have been sort of eight and 10-year gaps between records. So everyone's sort of very excited to find out what she produces.
It adds to her mystery, though. She's a woman of long hiatuses.
Yes.
And she, I always think of her in the same camp as Enya and Dido, these one-woman titles, these massive multi-million pound selling women that live, you can imagine, in castles, in turrets like the Ladies of Shalott, and they don't do interviews, put a record out every 10 years. They may be raising... I think she went to live in Barbados or something like that.
Yes, she did. She
relocated. And you can just imagine her, like, you know, just walking through the surf in a white nightie, never having to work again, and maybe just singing to herself. She is, in fact, quite an interesting woman. Her name is Helen Folashade Adu, Nigerian father, English mother, born in Nigeria. But when her parents divorced, her mother brought her over, and she grew up in Colchester, and she went to Clacton High School. And in her early life, she used to squat in Wood Green with the writer Robert Elms. So it's a strange kind of bringing down to earth of this mysterious character, Sade. But yeah, she doesn't... I mean, I've never seen an interview with her. I'm afraid, I imagine she does them every now and again, but...
I read an interview yesterday from 2000, was the kind of most recent, like, long-form interview I could find with...
What does she sound
with
like?
Echo Eschen.
Was she quite boring?
She didn't say much of interest, to be honest.
That's why she doesn't do interviews.
There's, you know, she doesn't... It's hard to put my finger on what's so appealing about her music. I'd say she doesn't give a lot away in her music either. She's quite... You know, she pulls her punches. She's quite restrained, really, which actually is maybe why it feels even more appealing now in a kind of era of Lady Gaga's and Beyoncé's and, you know...
Breast-beating.
Yeah, it's quite that sort of restraint and minimalism, although that is happening in other forms of music. It's not a big part of kind of big mainstream pop music at the moment.
It's actually a genre called Quiet Storm. Did you read about Quiet Storm?
Had you come across this before today? Yeah.
I'm fascinated.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
So this is a programming method. This is a DJ programming method in America of basically programming late night tunes, neo soul tunes with slick production, sort of slow beats, velvety sounding music. I think it was a Smokey Robinson phrase first off, but later on it was applied to Luther Vandross and Anita Baker and Sade. And it was about DJs putting this stuff on late at night, which when I was growing up in Norfolk was called Radio Broadland's The Mellow Zone. And it was the half hour that you got between 11:30 and 12, which is probably when everyone was having sex or something like that, or trying to go to sleep. And I used to listen to it. And it always had Sade on and Wonderful, right. Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton and stuff. But it actually got her music to America because they put her in these slots. Mm. And this was a recognised thing. You put your wireless on to kind of wind down with Quiet Storm.
Yeah, you look at what she's categorised with online and, you know, achieved success in the 1980s with songs that featured a sophisticated pop style, incorporating elements of soul, pop, smooth jazz, and Quiet Storm. But it's a great genre. I'm definitely going to start citing it more often. Interestingly, Sweetest Taboo uses the phrase Quiet Storm in it, which
wow.
I don't know if that's deliberate.
Well, when you just
not.
Said about it pulling punches as well, that's significant because this was R&B that was kind of devoid of its angst and its protest in a sense, so it kind of made it more listener friendly and very, very commercial. And I mean, I like the fact that her album titles have such strong names. They're called Promise, Stronger Than Pride, Soldier of Love.
Yeah,
they're kind of great. They're just like this weird warrior woman.
Yeah. And this is a period before kind of R&B became inextricably linked with hip hop, I guess. So it still has that kind of the sort of purity of that soul jazz R&B line before it kind of, I think that 92 record, she starts using drum machines. And actually, maybe that's why I like it so much, is that it kind of, you can just about see some DNA shared with something like the first record by Massive Attack, Blue Lines, which came out the year before.
Yeah, also she counts all these rappers among her fans. So Kanye West and Rakim, and actually Deftones are into her as well.
Really?
Lots of strange people think she's
rappers always like the smoothest of music.
Because rappers are great. Rappers don't have any prejudices about this kind of stuff. They're like, yeah, bring it all in, because they like to sample from everything. And also our very own Tracy Thorn is a big fan of Sade.
She's a fan, yeah.
I mean, the voices, it's a kind of a voice that I suppose I can hear a lot of sort of Sade in Dido as well, which was like a decade later or so, maybe a bit over that. But it is part of this neo-soul era where you had, you had black, brand new heavies and Simply Red, like you were saying, and Lisa Stansfield. And this was the music that is sort of almost forgotten in critical circles because it was so ubiquitous. It sold so well, but it wasn't edgy indie music. So this is what real people were listening to at dinner parties. And I think they've sold 75 million albums or something ridiculous.
Yeah, I've heard between 50 and 75. And one interesting thing is very early on in her career, she opted for, you know, a bit like those actors on the first Star Wars movie. Or who was it? Was it Alec Guinness on the first Star Wars movie? But she took quite a low kind of advance, but an increased royalties cut.
Ah.
And made an absolute fortune. So she had 15% or something royalties, which was well above.
So that's a gamble, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a gamble.
So that's the smart
confidence that paid off.
Smooth operator.
I think you know, partly these hiatuses were because she simply could afford it, I guess.
I was reading about and thinking about Smooth Operator, which I'd never really thought about the what that's about, but it reminds me a bit of, it's very 80s, it reminds me of the Milk Tray advert.
Yeah.
So this kind of figure of a, you know, international action man breaking hearts. Yeah. And then I was thinking, because the words are so weird. It goes coast to coast, LA to Chicago, Western Mail. Across the North and South to Key Largo, love for sale. So like, is he a gigolo? Because I was reading about gigolos and apparently they're really expensive. But you can get a gigolo for a night who's got no obligation to sleep with you or do anything at all, and it's a grand. So you could go for a drink with a gigolo tonight in London, you have to pay £1,000. So I'm thinking that maybe Smooth Operator.
Is there not some sort of price comparison website you could consult to
knock
that down?
You probably get budget gigolos. Cold-hearted men.
But again, I think that very 80s sophisticated setting of that track, perhaps I'm making undue claims for it here, but when I listen to it again, I really like, and this is where I think the Quiet Storm stuff is quite interesting, is it's actually, I think, sort of really clever and quite subtle instrumentation. You've got this like little distorted guitar riff going on in the background, like against the drums and keyboards, and they're kind of the band seem to sort of be doing their work really effectively on those sorts
of tracks. Yeah, it's so nice just listening to bands where musicians can play their instruments.
Yeah.
I was always on that side of the fence. I liked the Brand New Heavies a lot when I was a teenager. And everyone else was listening to grunge. I was like, I like the slick, smooth sounds. But yeah, it's not. And Jamiroquai for that reason. It was quite a kind of polished era, you know, the early 90s, late 80s.
Just briefly want to address the dinner party question. Mm. You mentioned that this was a kind of dinner party sound. And I think you're absolutely right, Sade and Simply Red. And later on, I kind of thought even things like Portishead's first album were just ubiquitous kind of late night listening. But I don't know now what would be the equivalent.
It might be something to do with the fact that the personal backstory is so much part of every new soul singer now. So that you don't, it's almost like the personality of Adele or Sam Smith or someone would sort of interfere with your dinner.
Yeah.
Whereas in those days, it was just, you know, the Soldier of Love just crooning. She hadn't released that yet, but, you know, she was like, it was just this kind of sense of a kind of sealed, polished sound that was just on in the background. And now it's so much more kind of emotionally out there and raw. And we were trying to work out, weren't we, who the equivalent is now. I don't know if anyone has any suggestions as to...
Yeah, send them in, because you're right, those big names like Adele, they just come with so much baggage, don't they? Oh, for God's sake.
I know, and Ed Sheeran as well, there's too much going on and it's too fast and annoying and it's too poppy. We were thinking maybe Emily Sandé.
Yeah.
But I just don't think anyone would admit to playing Emily Sandé at a dinner party. I just think, I don't know, that's what people do now. They have the bloody Spotify playlists that say
smooth, brunch. Chill, lazy brunch.
And that's probably Sade.
This is, Spotify has killed the dinner party album.
It has.
Go away and commission a 5,000 word feature on that subject. And it'll be published in next week's New Statesman, and you can read it there. In the meantime,
if you get it in by Monday morning, it'll be published next week.
In the meantime, I suggest you you go to your own record collection or to Spotify or whatever else and enjoy the remarkable back catalogue of Sade.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We have successfully lured our art critic and reviews editor, Michael Prodger, down from the second floor to the minus first floor to the podcast room to talk about Tate Britain's new exhibition, All Too Human, Bacon, Freud and a Century of Painting Life, which we've all been to see this week. It's just opened and it runs till 27th of August. Michael, bar the fact that the title contains Bacon and Freud, it's quite confusing. What's the organising principle of the show? Where does it start?
It starts really with the idea that in the 40s, in particular, 30s and 40s, some people thought that painting was dead. And indeed, in the immediate post-war years, it did have a slight crisis in that there were new art forms that came along that seemed to gain traction at the expense of traditional painting, such as abstract art, photography, the found object, and so on. And that painting had to do something to reinvent itself. Of course, it was a very short-lived crisis because you had abstract expressionism in America, in particular, which was all about painting, although it's in a new way. But in Britain, it seemed to presage an outpouring of painters, traditional painters, who worked in what's demonstrably a realist way, i.e. they took real objects and made a portrayal of them that's not necessarily mimetic and imitative, but certainly dealt with real objects. So Bacon and Freud are the two most celebrated examples. But the idea was that they worked with paint, and it's paint that the actual paint and thickness of paint that becomes the leitmotif of this whole post-war school. The American painter, honorary Brit, but an American painter called R.B. Kitaj, christened the school the School of London, and it had Bacon, Freud, Auerbach, Kossoff as the main, and Michael Andrews as the main figures within it. But then various other people were associated with it. And what the Tate show does is show an expanded version of that School of London.
It's a lovely section of London paintings as well, isn't there? I wasn't expecting that. So Auerbach paintings of Mornington Crescent, that he would go out every night and sketch the same view from a little cafe doorway opposite the other side of the tube station, and then produce these beautiful, very, very thick oil paintings. And it reminded me a bit in parts of... there was a great film made at the end of the 60s called The London Nobody Knows, like narrated by James Mason. And it was about the fact that whole swathes of London, of old London, were being knocked down by wrecking balls in that period, late 60s, early 70s. And it's funny to see some of these paintings, an Auerbach one of Dalston, I think, as well, and destroying houses in Dalston, and just think that this stuff has been going, you know, we've been sort of bemoaning the loss of old London for much longer than we think we have. We associate that with right now, but...
Well, of course, they were painting immediately after the war, when London was totally pockmarked and pitted by bomb and war damage. And
they loved it, didn't they?
They loved it. I mean, there's a very nice quote by Auerbach saying, likening London to a landscape full of crags and lakes and ravines and so on and so forth, which is exactly how it must have appeared if you half closed your eyes and smelt the brick dust. And that's what they painted. They didn't go to glamorous West End locations. Though, of course, David Bomberg, their great hero, and indeed the great hero of this exhibition, I think, in many ways, did paint St Paul's. But the others, they stayed out in the fringes a bit. I mean, Spitalfields is dead glam now, but it wasn't then. And Dalston, as you mentioned, and other sort of fringe venues were the real mainstays of their art. And so in some ways, they did memorialise not just unglamorous London, but the actual texture, the fabric of it at the time. And there's an extraordinary Auerbach painting of a big hole in the ground at Victoria Street, building site Victoria Street, it's called, of 1961, that is simply a great scooped hole in the earth. And it could be painted in clay. It also looks as if it could be painted in crap. I mean, it's a very sort of sewer-like painting of nothing, really. There's no form, structure, or detail in it. It's just squelch and mud and emptiness. But it's incredibly effective in the way that it transmits the idea of the base material of London and what it was all made from.
You both mentioned the sort of thickness of paint, but it is just worth emphasising that some of these paintings, particularly these Auerbach ones, there's one that particularly appealed to me, Rebuilding the Empire Cinema. You get up close to it and it's sort of, if I could lay it horizontally, it would be very much like the sort of battle diorama scenes that my dad used to make for me to play toy soldiers on. I mean, it really, like, the paint curls and peaks up in mounds and crags, and it kind of, you know, I didn't know whether this was a step too far, but thinking about when they were done, it does seem almost like a sort of battle-scarred landscape in one way.
They're sort of thick as electric cables, aren't they? They look like the inner workings of the building that's actually been exploded, and that's the paint that he's using.
I mean, I don't know for sure, but with Kossoff and Auerbach, who are the two really the paint junkies who really lay it on literally with a trowel at times, you wonder if they had to paint with the actual support, the canvas flat.
Yes. Because
the weight of paint is so heavy that it would have slid off. Either that, or they had to work at a very great, very slow time scale so that each layer had a chance to dry thoroughly before applying the next. Otherwise, like badly applied grouting, it would just gently slide down the canvas.
Because oil needs how long to dry?
It depends on which drying agents you, which drying oils you put with it. But I mean, it's days to weeks rather than getting over and done within in an hour. Modern acrylics are slightly different, but it's a slow and painful process. But of course, the idea that you get, the image that you get from these works, is that they're instinctive and quick and are snapshots of a sensation in a moment and an instant of certainly the built environment's being, rather than something that's hugely carefully considered and organically grown over a great length of time.
Tell us a bit about this. There's a whole section of the exhibition which looks at what your hero Bomberg described as the hand and eye disease, which was a movement, particularly William Coldstream and Uglow, who were actually doing portraiture, but they were measuring things out in a very, very scientific manner and leaving the measuring marks on the canvas. So there's a Uglow painting here, which took 5 years to complete. There's another one which took 60 sittings, each of which was an hour long. What was that about? And how did that sort of fit into this movement in general, that little period of this very scientific way of empathising with the object in the room?
Well, it was a Slade school thing. Slade has obviously always been a very important teaching environment. And these painters, Coldstream taught there, Uglow was a student, Lucian Freud was brought in by Coldstream to be a tutor, their visiting tutor at one point. And it was all about the intensity of the gaze. I'm sorry to get into terminology like that, but that's really what it was about, that you had to look very long, very hard, very minutely. So in the way that modern photographers, if they're doing a series of images of, let's say, the sun rising and setting over a piece of landscape, they'll put their tripod in one place, mark it, And then they can go back and put the tripod in exactly the same place every time they want to take the next image to get a composite finished work. The painters were doing that. People like Johan Uggla were looking, setting a model in a very sort of nondescript room on a nondescript chair and pinning him or her to the canvas, literally with these little grid marks. The difference is that instead of covering them up afterwards, I mean, this is no different in many ways to old Renaissance ways of painting, which you'd use a framework with a grid, and then you could square it up on your drawing and you could square the drawing up onto the painting. They would then, of course, hide the marks, whereas Uggla and Coldstream wanted to make the sheer effort and the time scale that went into making the works somehow apparent on the canvas. Hmm. The really interesting painter here is Lucian Freud, who went from this school of working to a much freer handling of paint, though even when he was at his most painterly, i.e. slathering the stuff on, he would still take, even for a tiny little portrait, he would still take 20, 30, 60 sittings. So in every single painting, even when it looks as if it's done been painted relatively quickly, it is the equivalent of 3 weeks of the sitter sitting absolutely stock still while this image was created.
Some of the most patient models in sort of 20th century art.
That's right. Well, I think that's why so many of Freud's sitters, he showed them asleep, because they couldn't physically...
Like, you know, Big Sue.
I mean, yes, I mean...
Very voluptuous lady in there. What's the name of that painting again? Asleep with the lion carpet.
Behind the lion curtains, I think. Yes, I mean, she's Big Sue Tilly, who was his benefits supervisor sleeping, which was the bought by Abramovich for a record amount, I mean, 50, 60, 70 million, whatever it was. And he painted her several times. And you can feel not just the weight of her flesh dragging her into sleep, but just the sheer ennui of sitting for Freud.
Or the wives who then are dispatched with quite soon after
the painting's finished. I love the details that, the little details about the way these painters developed, so that the look that we associate with Freud paintings now, the sort of voluminous flesh and the strange angles and the kind of looming bottom half and the head reclining on the sedan or whatever, it actually came from him starting to stand up rather than sit down to do his paintings.
Yeah.
Which seemed like such a strange small detail to me, that the idea of Freud sitting down is, I can't imagine that, because he's such a kind of commanding presence. You imagine he was always standing up doing his oil painting.
But he changed in a way that was really quite rare for painters. His style did a complete volte-face in the 60s and 70s, from this miniaturist style in which he was basically an heir to Flemish Renaissance painters such as Memling, this miniaturist detail and careful concentrated vision, in which you can see him sitting at an easel in order to recreate every single hair and pore, to this completely different manner. And I think one of the things that you get from simply that change of viewpoint is that he looks down on his subjects and the backgrounds, which the curators of the show make a great play of their, they're just as important as the sitters, which may or may not be true. But what you get from that standing viewpoint is that it shows how he got to these skewed floorboards that go at unstable angles, and chairs appear wonky because you're standing up rather than sitting and looking at something square on. And all those, that lack of stability that plays off against the rock solid physical presence of the sitter is one of the things that make his picture so queasy in many ways.
Did Bacon go through a similar transition?
No, Bacon didn't. He was always far more expressive. And indeed, one of the really, I think the most exciting room in the show is an early one of early Bacon's from the 50s, with a couple of paintings which is devoted to him, and for some reason, well, you can understand the reason, but it's still slightly random. One Giacometti sculpture that stands there that you barely notice, and it's the only sculpture in the show. And it's, anyway, the curators no doubt had good reasons of their own to do it. It's a bit odd.
But those, they just found it.
It was existentialist angst. Existentialist
and the figure alone.
Leaving your thumbprints on the clay versus leaving your marks on the canvas.
I think if you're going to have sculptures, then have sculptures. Why not have an Anthony Gormley or something in there?
Why not?
Or a Henry Moore, who you could easily make a case for following the same sort of route as some of these these are some of the painters.
Is this the painting that looks a bit like a figure slumped over barbed wire with kind of pistons shoved in its eyes?
Yeah, I mean, that's deeply strange. I was thinking more indeed, in fact, of those ones of animals. There's one of a howling baboon and and a dog that seems to me, I mean, nobody can quite tell what's going on with these pictures, but it seems to me it's a dog that's chased its own tail to the point of exhaustion, and you're not quite sure whether it is aggressive or exhausted or simply reached some sort of stasis where nothing is going on whatsoever because it's all clapped out. But I think what Bacon was doing there, I mean, he never used paint in the same way as Freud went on to do it. It's never as thick. And indeed, he's a very beautiful painter in that so many of his brushstrokes are very fine and refined. But you get this horrible, aggressive, violent, distressing subject matter in almost all his work, which shows that you don't need to layer the stuff on to get maximum effect from it.
The baboon's teeth are not that dissimilar to the Laughing Pope series, are they? There's sort of this horrible primal scream, as you say in your piece, the jaws wrenched open, you can't really see the face. I didn't know his animal paintings at all. Did you, Tom?
I didn't, and there's a sort of something you pick up on throughout the show is a kind of... a slight coldness that comes with a lot of these painters' approach to their subjects, in that they are, as you say, they're pinning them on the canvas. That even saying pinning implies a kind of slight kind of clinical, you know, detachment. But no one seems close to me to Bacon's kind of angst and despair that he captures in his portraits. I wonder where, because you've got two schools, you've got this Slade school and the Bomberg school at Borough Polytechnic. Is Bacon a bit of a sort of outlier in this, or you know, how does he fit in terms of the traditions?
Well, he was Irish, so for a start, and he had this strange. He was very interested in animals. I mean, he claimed he lost his virginity to his father's groom, but he had an interest in horse flesh, and there was this degree of self-loathing in there, and in his paintings that the others, I'm not sure. Did have, and he had this convoluted sexuality. I mean, it was sadomasochistic homosexuality, and although I think he came to terms with it, he came to terms with it through his paintings in some sense. So heavy drinking, brutal sex, Soho low life, and you can sense, you don't even need to know it because you can sense it in his paintings. David Hockney once said of Bacon's paintings, "Yeah, you can smell the balls." and you know, it's actually in the way that Hockney can do, he can brilliantly summarize a sensation of painting, and you can, whether you want to or not. You know, there's a whiff of the a tang of the unpleasant in there. And so Bacon had brought other stuff to painting that some of the others weren't quite as psychologically as complicated as him.
And what about the way they socialised? Because they did all go
they
out
drank
and drink
in the Colony Club, didn't they?
Yeah, Muriel Belcher's Colony Club, and they sort of the School of London, the hardcore School of London. They hung around together, they drank together, they discussed painting together. They didn't actually paint together, but they painted each other a lot. So Michael Andrews has got a painting of the Colony Club with a lot of painters in it. Freud painted Bacon painted Freud. Freud painted Auerbach, and so on and so forth. Auerbach painted Auerbach. They all used each other, not just as drinking buddies and you know, fellow carousers, but as in an artistic sense as well.
Who was the most dangerous on the night out, do you reckon?
Oh, it was Bacon.
Definitely Bacon.
Bacon was... They'd start off in Soho, and you know, but Soho got tame because they then went down to the East End and it got seriously hairy.
The Michael Andrews paintings are such a contrast in a sense because of the sheer sociability of them, aren't they? There's a room of his stuff and they're just so heavily peopled compared to the lone figures in Freud and Bacon. I like the fact that you've got somebody like him commentating on the same scene, but from a completely different viewpoint and probably a more normal viewpoint as well.
Well, I think
possibly a more normal person.
Yeah, I think he was a more normal person. Though the curators there, a lot of Michael Andrews' work that's not shown in the exhibition is actually quite empty. Or that the number of figures are pared down to ones or twos.
Ah,
and he also did landscape
painting.
So I think the curators have talked up the sociability side. I think he was far more social. You know, I think he was a social being and interested in that. But a lot of his painting is still isolation as a theme in it.
Mm. What do you think about it as a curated show? Did you have any doubts about the way it's put together? Obviously, the paintings are wonderful, but you know the way that they're actually ranged around and who's chosen.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a show like this rather invites you to say, why isn't so-and-so in it? Why is so-and-so in it? The story that's traditionally told of School of London and post-war British painting is white, male, and all born in the 30s and 40s. So what the curators have done, have expanded the school to include other painters, notably a group of female painters. If there was a School of London female painter, it's probably Gillian Ayres. She doesn't feature, but they've brought Paula Rego in, who's a Portuguese Londoner. Indeed, she was taught by Coldstream. But her work seems to me not in the same vein as the others. And then a group of younger painters from Cecily Porter, Jenny Saville, who are contemporary, much younger, born in the late 60s, early 70s. Who there's a certain spiritual fellow feeling, but again, I think that is pushing the idea of the School of London into a gendered sphere that doesn't necessarily work. I think
they're all crammed in one room as well, aren't
and
they?
They're in one room, and it's the last, end. And it's the last room
next to the door.
Yeah, it seems rather a willful bit of curating that somebody that you know they sat down and this is me imagining. I'm sure they didn't, but they sat down and said, right, we need to get some women in here. How do we do this? And then we'll say, right, we've got a room spare. Let's shove a few in there. And I'm not sure it does either the painters or the show a huge service.
Before we get trapped in a gendered sphere, which I would hate us to do, we should call it a day on that. But it is a fascinating exhibition, well worth seeing, All Too Human, on at Tate Britain until the 27th of August.
So, for our non-anniversary this week, in March 2000, which is, by my reckoning, 18 years ago?
That's an easy one, yeah.
18 years ago, a film franchise took the world, which went on for 11 years, 5 films, directed by a combination of James Wong, David Ellis, and Stephen Quayle. The Final Destination series, which, in my opinion, was one of the best horror movie series ever created, because it was a very, very simple concept. And Tom had not seen these, but I sent Tom a clip today of a gymnastics death.
I thought these films were some kind of budget sci-fi operation. I had no idea what was going on. So I clicked on this link that Kate sent me, and it's an American gymnasium with a series of kind of faults in the room that are exposed, faulty light fitting, frayed cable. And basically you watch over about 5 minutes in absolute agony, a gymnast avoid all of these kind of potentially dangerous situations, only for a rapid kind of domino effect to happen in the last 30 seconds and for her to suffer a brutal and horrific death. It was absolutely horrible. I can't get it out of my head now. I wish I'd never watched it.
There are no films so tense, apart from possibly Halloween, but that's very different. The great thing about Final Destination was that there was no baddie. There were no aliens, there were no
apart
monsters.
From fate.
Fate was the only, the invisible baddie. And you basically watch a load of hapless, unknown young actors who are, you know, frat boys and girls in little teams of young people trying to get on with their lives, submitting to horrific accidents. And the whole tension of the films are just waiting to see what's going to happen next. And they have some very pedestrian but very inventive deaths. There is a famous death in a tanning booth, with some girls listening to Roller Coaster by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who get snapped into the tanning booth and burn there.
Oh, gosh.
There's a death during laser eye surgery.
Oh.
There's a death during a massage, which is one of my favourites. And then there's a very effective death on a roller coaster where it's much more realistic, where one little tiny nail pings out of one of the carts and sets off a kind of mousetrap of accidents. I think they're brilliant. they don't really get talked about. And then they finished in 2011. And then by that point, they were 3D. So you get bits of brain flying out at your glasses.
Basically for fans of industrial accidents or accidents in the workplace.
For experts in occupational health.
Yeah.
And then it ties up so perfectly because the very first film begins with a boy getting on a plane, having a vision that the plane's going to explode and demanding to be taken off. He escapes fate, and then the rest of the film is watching what happens to him. 11 years later, the fifth Final Destination film ends with that very plane with two other people who think they're escaping for a new life. And just out the corner of your eye, you can see the first boy from 11 years earlier being dragged off the plane saying, this thing's going to explode. And then, of course, it does. And then there's like a montage of the best deaths with AC/DC playing over the top. And then they just wrapped it up with dignity and said, we've done this. No more.
With dignity. Happy non-anniversary, Final Destination. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Back Half. I've been Tom.
I've been Kate.
Thank you to Michael Prodger for talking to us about Freud and Bacon. Thanks to Caroline Crampton for editing this podcast. Please do go on iTunes and rate us or get in touch with us via Twitter. And we are going to play you out with, not with Sade, sadly,
not
but
with
something almost as good.
Maybe one day with Sade. And in the meantime, by the people who are heavily influenced by Sade.
Almost certainly.
Carbon copy of Sade. Pistol Jazz with their song Godspeed.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.